Hello, my name is Daniel Marino, and this is Motion Martial Arts Podcast. I'm in the UK at the moment, and this past weekend I attended a four-day residential seminar with Ian Abernethy. For those that don't know him, Ian has been a guest on this podcast before, and he is a specialist in creating practical applications for the movements found in traditional karate kata. It was a really fun time, and I learned a lot of great stuff and met a lot of great people. Ian was kind enough to sit down with me and talk about some common misconceptions about kata and how kata can be best used in your training. I hope you enjoy. Just sitting down with me, Ian. And today,
happy to do it.
Yep. So today we're going to talk about kata specifically. You know, I would say why kata is a good training method, something that can bring a lot of value to your training. So I thought a good way to start is I just pulled up a couple of quotes that I found actually from a post on your forum online. And the first one is from Gichin Funakoshi, and it's, "Knowledge of just the sequence of a kata in karate is useless."
Yeah, I would agree. And he goes on to say, you know, it must be able to be applied in an emergency, you see.
Sure.
So yeah. I think that's probably one of the best quotes for indicating how the role of kata within karate has changed. So there you've got the guy who's regarded as being the father of modern karate, definitely a key player, saying just knowing the form and the solo form is useless.
Yeah.
It has to have a practical combative function. And although a lot of people will agree with that on face value, they don't have a process which that would take place.
Yeah, I found that's the most common, you know, criticism that I find of kata out there from non-karate people, and also like most, a really common misconception that you also find with it too. It's this idea that, you know, the way, I guess the one that I hear more than anything else is that, like, why do we do kata?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, it's just to teach you to move, teach you movement.
Yeah.
And it's like, but this move, the way that we're moving here is completely different than anything else we do. It's not like the way we spar. It's not like kumite. Yeah. It's not like what are we learning to move for with it? So there's no real meaning behind it.
No. And that's right. They do it as a solo form, and then they're not understanding that its purpose. And I think that's one of the things when kata's criticized, as someone who's a great believer in kata, I can often agree with those criticisms of it, because it all depends what you mean by kata. Yeah. So I don't know which other quote you picked, so I might maybe don't jump into too much depth at this point, but no. What I will say is that, you know, kata without combative function, I'll just finish on this analogy, right? So it's like if you had a beautiful looking car, you know, you walk out and that car is immaculate and it's polished and it's bright and shiny and it looks fantastic, and people go, you know, look at that car, and go, yeah, it's beautiful. They go, yeah, it's no engine in it and it's never moved. You know, so then you can say, well, is that car a good car? Because it's unable to fulfill the purpose that the car is supposed to be able to fulfill.
Sure.
So kata that is not contributing towards combative ability is useless.
Yeah.
You know, I agree with Funakoshi when he says
it's supposedly contributing in some vague,
undefined way.
Yeah.
There has to be a clearly identified process. So we can maybe talk about some of the other quotes, and I can maybe expand on what that process would be based on.
Okay, this is one of the longer quotes, and it's one that also has a little bit of an historical element to it too. It says, it's from Kenwa Mabuni, and you know, I'm actually not sure exactly when this quote would be from. You might be able to, you know, tell us that, but the karate that has been introduced to Tokyo is actually just a part of the whole. The fact that those who have learnt karate there feel it only consists of kicks and punches, and that throws and locks are only to be found in judo or jujitsu, can only be put down to a lack of understanding. Those who are thinking of the future of karate should have an open mind and strive to study the complete art.
Yeah. So it's a really good quote. He's talking about the value of studying a wide range of kata within that's a context it's come from, particularly like the value of studying both the shurite and the nate. But there we, and he's not alone in doing this either, so there we have him saying that the karate of his time, he's starting to observe that locking and throwing is starting to disappear, the grappling side of it. If you look at someone like Funakoshi talks about, you know, he says that, you know, karate has both the hard and the soft. He says it gives the art like a beautiful texture, the fact it's got softer methods, locking and throwing, and harder methods, the impacting. Look at the older text, you see throwing and locking as being a wide part of it. Lots and lots of quotes and references to this side. Now, so karate is definitely a percussive system. It is a striking system. But that's the method that it favours. But you can't impose what your preferences on reality. So if someone grabs you, you need grabbing skills, and they knew that. So when we're looking at the kata, they're definitely there. They're definitely there in the old text. So my view, if you're studying traditional karate, you do need to keep that on your mind. You do need to study the complete martial art. And it's grappling in a self-defense context as well. When you say the word grappling, some people think of high-level MMA, BJJ-style grappling. That's not in the kata at all.
The next couple of quotes will address that directly.
Yeah, that's it. It's not there. What we're talking about is, a friend of mine calls it primal grappling.
Sure.
So it's dealing with, you know, the kind of things that are likely to occur in a self-defense scenario, not the kind of things when two skilled grapplers are trying to out-grapple one another. Yeah.
Kind of things you did in wrestling with your brothers growing up.
Yeah, exactly. That's
the way I think of it at your seminars and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. What comes natural to human beings, you know, gripping of clothing, headlocking, strangles, you know, simple pressures on the throat, that kind of stuff. The kata is designed to address. So having said that, I have an idea which quotes are coming next. The old school karate should be an open art, and you can't understand your kata unless you understand that too.
Because, for
example, we talked about this over this weekend, right? There's throwing things in there that are clearly throws within the old school karate and the old school katas, but because modern karateka haven't got the eyes for that, they reinterpret it into bizarre, this is two double blocks and all kind of bizarre stuff. Where you show the same movement to a grappler, they'll go, it looks like a shoulder throw to me, you know.
It's definitely related to that first quote, and that, you know, just knowledge of just the sequence coming from this understanding of karate that everything is a kick, a punch, or a block.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's like the kata is just, there's no explanation that really can be given for what you're doing there. No convincing explanation that can be given for what the meaning of the movements are.
Well, that's it. You two guys happen to punch you at the same time, and it's hard enough to block a single thing, never mind two things at once.
Yeah.
You know, perfect angles to one another and things. That's not going to happen. So I think that the kata gets reinterpreted in a way because people don't understand what it's trying to represent, that it is this holistic civilian self-protection system, the physical side of it's there recording the katas. And if you can see that, then you're free to explore that side of the karate. If you don't get that, you're practicing, you know, as like a shell of the art, really.
Yep. Okay, so the next one is, the techniques of kata have their limits and were never intended to be used against an opponent in an arena or on a battlefield, by Choki Motobu.
Yeah. So that one, I believe it's Nagamimi reporting what Motobu said to him.
Yeah.
And if I remember that, and this is from memory, so I could be wrong, but if I remember, I think that was done in response to Motobu who had been training with a wrestler. And obviously the wrestler wrestled him, you see. So when they were talking about afterwards, six the cat round designed for dealing with it with a trained grappler. One of the issues with that quote is, to me, that makes perfect sense. Some karateka, when they hear that, think that we're saying, oh yeah, karate will work against these know-nothing criminals, but it won't work against these high-level martial artists, you see. And there's a huge arrogance in that, where it's like martial artists assuming themselves to be the ultimate apex predators in all environments, right?
Sure.
Now, I know people that I'd happily face them on a mat all day long. I wouldn't want to face them down a back alley. I wouldn't want to face them in a pub car park, you know? There's some scary, scary people. And so the analogy I use with that one, it's like sharks or lions, right? Both are apex predators, but if you put the shark in the middle of the ocean, it's no great threat.
Yeah.
If you put the shark in the middle of the plains, again, it's no great threat.
Yeah.
So that quote to me is not saying, oh yeah, karate is good for defeating untrained people, people with no skill. It's saying this is the kind of people it's set to address, and the most skilled criminals can be incredibly skilled at what they do. They can be incredibly skilled at overwhelming people with violence in order to achieve their ends.
Well, I remember a previous seminar I've been to of yours, you brought up a really good point with that, you know, kind of the arrogance of martial artists. When we say untrained, we tend to think not dangerous.
Yeah, unskilled.
Because they aren't trained. Just like that, that's not a very good way of going about it.
No, yeah. That's it, because they may not be trained, but that doesn't mean they're unskilled. They can be highly skilled criminals. If a guy has been using violence to achieve criminal aims day in, day out for a long period of time, he is the apex predator in that environment. So I'll give it like a friend of mine who was a lovely guy now, but in his youth he was a wild man, right? Hundreds and hundreds of fights. You would not want to get on the wrong side of him. And we were talking about how he would approach these violent situations. And he said, he goes, I would hit them with my right hand. He says, if they were still standing, I would headbutt them. If they were still standing, I would run away. Right? And this is a guy who knocked out hundreds of people. Now you put him in a ring or in a mat, he's going to lose and lose very, very quickly. But you stick him, in that criminal context and that environment, he's a very, very scary man, because he'll hit you before you realize he's even there. Sure. That's what we're talking about. It's a preemption, that's deception, that strong forward press, and it's that the Cat is designed to address. So it does have its limits. So for me, I never want to be a one-dimensional martial artist, so our guys will play it out fighting each other, which I call consensual violence. So we'll learn how to punch one another, how to throw one another. That's part of what we do for fun and enjoyment and learning a skill. And then we have what we call non-consensual violence, which is the violence of criminals. And the physical skills within kata, that's what they're there to address. So it's not better or worse, it's just using the right tool for the right job. That's the key thing.
It's definitely something worth taking into account. Karate has developed and changed as an art, in more recent decades. The same way things like point fighting and kickboxing have their basis in karate, that's a part of the art now too. So, and that's all consensual. So this quote from Motobu, from a long time ago, about karate as original karate from the time that the katas were created.
Have you got the Itosu quote in there as well?
That's coming up.
We'll drop into that because that's another one that supports that as well, I think.
So next one from Itosu's, and I abridged it a little bit, but it says, karate is a method of using the hands and feet to avoid injury should one by chance be confronted by a villain or ruffian.
That's one of the oldest full bits of text we've got, it written in 1908, and it's a letter where he's outlining what karate is and what the benefits of practicing it can be, and that's the second line of the first precept. So the first line is saying that it's not just about protecting you, it's about protecting others, and the second line of the first precept is that karate is not intended to be used against a single adversary, so a consensual fight. It's a method of avoiding injury by using the hands and feet should one by chance be confronted by a villain or ruffian. So he's saying that the method of the karate of his time, and you're right, it's evolved a lot, but the karate of the kata, traditional kata, is not for a consensual duel. Mm-hmm. It's for non-consensual violence against criminals. And again, I always worry when you say this because people use... So you get people go, that wouldn't work against a trained fighter because they believe a trained fighter is to be superior. Sure. And on the other side, you'll get, that wouldn't work in self-defense because self-defense is superior. And I don't believe that to be true. I believe it's simply a matter of using the right tool for the job. So if I'm facing criminal violence, I need to use the right tools to enable the right result. If I'm involved in a consensual duel with a fellow martial artist, my self-defense tools will get me nowhere. But if I use my consensual violence tools in self-defense, I'm likely to get into trouble. So the analogy one of my instructors uses, he goes, when martial artists fight, they sit down to play chess. This is an advanced, highly skilled game.
Sure.
And he says, and in self-defense, he says, they sit down expecting a game of chess, and the criminal throws the pieces at the face and then smashes the head in with a board. Yeah. Now, there's no doubt who's the best chess player. Yeah. So that you can be a better fighter than that criminal, but the criminal is still being a better criminal unless we understand the differences. And there's a lot to that. But once you understand that it's that non-consensual violence, when you look at the methods, positions, the movements of the cat, and go, okay, that makes sense. I get what that's about now.
Yeah.
If you try and take that and apply it against another martial artist, you then go, well, why haven't they got guards? Where's the back and forth footwork? Where's the feinting? But if you understand it's for close range, non-consensual violence, to my eyes, it all makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, it's just completely different things, for that. And there's, of course, some overlap, A punch is kind of a punch. And there's certainly things between self-defense and fighting that you can find skills to transfer, but it's just the situations could not be more different.
No.
And you and another guy or another martial artist squaring up and trying to see who's better at a specific skill set versus being attacked.
Well, I think that's it. The big difference is So, for example, if for non-consensual violence, you have asymmetrical goals.
Yeah.
So the criminal is going, I want to harm you, I want to take what it is from you, and you're going, I don't want to get harmed.
Yeah.
For consensual violence, you have symmetrical goals. You go, right, we both agree what a win is, we both agree what methods we're going to use, yeah. You know, and we both agree what's allowed and what's not allowed. Now let's go. Whether that's two guys stepping outside for, in air quotes, street fight, because I hate that quote, or two guys sitting onto a mat or into a ring or into a cage, that they've agreed to be there.
Yeah.
And the very fact that they agree and have a common goal makes it very different from when people don't agree and have asymmetrical goals. Yeah. It is quite different. Again, not better or worse. You know, and I get a little bit annoyed by the people that try and play one off against the other.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of using the right tool for the right job. And as you say, I mean, you get a guy who's a highly skilled kickboxer, right?
Yeah.
Or a highly skilled MMA guy, highly skilled BJJ guy, you know, they will have in abundance the physical skills that they'll need for self-defense, but you need to contextualize it so they're using it properly.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So, you know, you had some, you know, some simple striking skills. Your objective is to escape, not to win. You need to take into account legal considerations. You need to take into account the criminal behavior and what their objective is. So again, it's not better or worse. Again, it's just using the right tool for the right job. You know,
okay.
You enter a judo match and try and box, you're going to lose, but sure. That doesn't mean a boxer can't fight.
Makes sense. So that was the last of the quotes. You know, I also just want to talk a little bit about where I've gone with kata in my training. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can talk about, you know, the way that you specifically use it, the stuff that you do. But, you know, for the last year about, I've almost exclusively only practiced one,
which
would be Nihachi. I use it kind of as a warm up when I start training.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'll practice hitting pads with the strikes or found Nihachi. I'll practice, you know, with a partner, applying, you know, some of the joint locks, takedowns, stuff like that, and also sparring with them from a clinch in that way. And, you know, it's just such a radically different approach from the way that I've spent, you know, the vast majority of the time that I've been training doing kata, where it was just something that you did that just stood entirely on its own, that, you know, kind of given vague explanations for why you were doing it, like it strengthens your body and it teaches you to move and stuff like that. And it's really just been a game changer for me, and one that has made it's turned it into something that seems so much more alive. It's exciting for me too. It's something that I'm delving into it, and it's like learning, it's about seeing something that has been so familiar to me for a long time, seeing it in a completely, like I was looking at, it's like the iceberg type theory, that like I understood Nihachi from the idea of just a very small piece of it. That's all that I knew of it. And then as you delve into it, you see how big and vast of a thing it really can be.
Funakoshi there's another quote of his. He said, he says, in the past they studied narrow and deep. Today they study broad and shallow.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So now, you know, it's not unusual for your average downgrade. You know, how many katas, you know, 15, 16, up to 20s.
Yeah.
You know, as Funakoshi said back in his days, he says, the most skilled martial artist would know one, one or two. You know what I mean? He says, you know, the most extremely knowledgeable would know three. Because... if you're just learning the surface form of it, you can learn a lot. You know, you can learn a lot of them. But I liken that to collecting seeds. It's like, I've got hundreds of acorns, but I've got no oak tree. You know, they're not planting the seed and letting it grow. So that would probably be a good chance to talk about the process of it, you know. So you've got the way I acknowledge it. So if people go, kata won't help you in a real fight, they are completely correct. Yeah. If they are looking at kata in an isolation, it's like saying an acorn isn't a tree. That's an obvious statement of fact, but the misunderstanding the role of the kata. So in summary, the four-stage model I use is, there's the solo form, which is, you know, the repository of knowledge, and it's a way of supplementary, not primary, it's a way of supplementary solo training. So you've got that. Then what you've got is, you've got drilling the applications to those forms with a partner. So in the first instance, that will be done in a compliant way and in drills, so students get an idea of what the kata is trying to teach and show. They get a feel of doing it against an actual body. The third stage is that you realize that these drills that you've done from the Katara are not the totality of it. They are illustrations of concepts and principles. So you then go, right, if the Katara shows me this, how else can I enact this? How do I vary this? How does this work if the guy's bigger than me, smaller than me, pushing left, pushing right? You do all those variations. And a key one is you gain live experience of doing it. So I think for some people, they view Katara as being a alternative to life practice rather than being something that informs that life practice. And when you're doing that, when you're doing the solo form on the days where you haven't got a training partner, and that changes too, because you've got all these other ways of training, your solo kind of changes because it's constantly reinforcing those experiences. If you haven't got those experiences to be reinforced, it's empty. But you do the solo form, you do the applications with a partner, realistic applications, not some guy throwing lunging punches 10 feet away. You interpret the way the kind of that Mota Booney Tosu told us to. You get used to adapting it and varying it and understanding that the Katara is an illustration of concept and principle, and then you gain live experience of doing it through what we call Katara-based sparring, and you have live drills which enable you to enact those Katara methods against a resisting opponent. And I know for a lot of people, they go, how does that possibly work? Because they often have very fixed ideas of what Katara is and sparring is.
Sure.
But you and I both know those two can link together perfectly.
Oh, yeah absolutely.
It's
a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. And then the wonderful thing about it is everyone can do it too.
Yeah.
So you may not be able to step onto a mat and win medals anymore, throw those head out roundhouse kicks. Your body might not be able to stand those heavy takedowns and submissions. But the kata based stuff, because it's not just one kind of sparring, there are lots of it.
Yeah.
I have ones that I'll get the kids to do. I've got ones that I'll get 70-year-old guys to do, and everything in between. You know, it definitely, and I know what you mean. It's then that when you look at the kata, you're seeing it's dead.
Yeah.
You know, it's not totally dead. You know, it's like a dormant seed. But when you start to apply the process and it lives and breathes, it's then that you start to say, man, these things are genius.
Yeah.
They're a work of genius.
Well, yeah, you see it also that, you know, it's kind of like the solo performance of a kata is just one expression of the underlying principles behind it. So that's why it becomes this vast thing, because you can take that information, you can vary it, that's how you're able to spar with it, because sparring is chaotic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And because, you know, there's so many different things that can happen in there, but it's able to address it in that way. So it, and that's one of the reasons why, and the quote used from Funakoshi is a really good one, that's like, I'm a teacher, so, you know, I work with a large number of the kata. But in my own training, I really have only been using the Hapshi because it's the only one I feel that I have any sort of like really solid, you know, grasp of.
Yeah.
In a way that I can apply it well. The rest of them, I've been to enough of your events that, you know, I've worked with them a lot, and, you know, they're on the horizon for me. I would like to branch into other ones, but it's enough. It's, I guess, all I really need.
Yeah, you only need one good understanding of one, and you've got an illustration of those concepts. And you, for me, it is Nahanchi too. The Nahanchi and the Pinan series are my core, and the other ones I explore to inform that core.
Yeah,
you know, but those. So you've got those five pretty short katas and the Pinans. You've got Nahanchi or Nahanchi Shodan, as people call it. You've got one short one there that keeps my guys going up to their first dan, which typically in my school takes about 8 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want to learn the solo form of them, I could probably teach you most of them in a week.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We could get that done in a week. But to learn them properly, and I'm not, you know, I still feel I'm learning for them. But to learn them to a point where you can apply them, there's a lot of information in those.
Yeah. And, you know, another small point I feel like it's worth bringing up too is just, I know we mentioned it earlier on, is that, you know, having a piece of your practice, that's all that the solo kata is, just a small piece of the whole. With it, which is, you know, the main misconception I'd say there is about kata, that all that it is, it's just that solo practice. That's all there is. But having that too has a lot of value, because it's something that when I have nothing else, if it's me, you know, in a couple of days, I'm gonna go and see Stonehenge after the seminar is finished here this weekend. Like, I'll be staying in a hotel room, and it's like, what kind of training can I do in the hotel room there? Well, I could go through Nahachi a few times.
Yeah.
You know, very confined space. I could do some push ups. You know, it's kind of thing. It's like, it's useful. It's a good tool to have, that you have this little solo routine that is part of your training that you can bring with you anywhere. You can do anywhere. You know, you don't need anything for it.
No, that's it. I mean, you know, the arts that don't have kata don't need it. But for the arts that have, they are absolutely central. See, I'm someone who travels a lot. I always say Nahanchi's my travel category because I can do it anywhere. I put a video on my app this week of me doing a hotel workout, and that's what it was. I did Nahanchi.
So I did that one.
But that's, you know, they're always told, like, you know, you must do the category with deadly seriousness. You must visualize the enemy and all that kind of stuff. And visualization is, that's scientifically proven to have a solid effect. Yeah. If you're doing that visualization that in a way that you're not just sitting there thinking about it, you're moving in that way while you're doing that visualization, that is a powerful process because it's cementing the habits that you got from your partner training. So if you're only doing that one element, no matter how pretty your cattle looks, it hasn't, you haven't got the experiences for that kata to reinforce.
Yeah.
But if you've sparred with the kata, you've done bunkai with the kata, you've adapted and varied, every time you do that kata with that visualization, it's just cementing those habits. And I mean, you'll have heard me say this, you don't fight with kata, you don't fight with bunkai, you don't fight with drills, you fight with the habits that the kata, the bunkai, and the drills have given you. So, and any habit is based on things you do a lot. So if you haven't got a training partner, then visualization is proven, scientifically proven to be really valid. And you do that along with that accompanying motion, you're cementing those habits. So it's another chance to train when there's no one there.
Sure.
But you're right, people do overemphasize it. You do solo cattle on your own, forever, it will do zero to make you a better fighter. But if you have it as part of the process, that's when it really starts to do its thing.
Yeah. Funakoshi explicitly stated. You know, it's funny too with a guy like Funakoshi, because often called the father of modern karate, and you read a statement like that and it's just,
well,
he's
interesting because, like, I mean, keeping it really short, the karate guys realized what was popular. Judo was popular, so they copy judo, they rip it off effectively. You know, it becomes karate do, not karate anymore. They adopt belts, they adopt white suits, they adopt the ethos. It's about keeping bodies and fit and strong, and Funakoshi was a genius that did that, because if he hadn't done that, it would never have spread, and you or I would never have heard of karate. It was a thing done by a couple of hundred people in Okinawa a few hundred years ago, and it'll have died out.
Sure.
Although he may get criticized for decloying a little bit, that decloying exercise enabled it to spread. However, having started that off, I lead his later writings, and I can't help but feel there's a tinge of regret. He's obviously very proud of what he's done, but if you read his introduction to the final edition of Karate Do Kyohan, he's now an old guy, the younger guys are kind of running with karate, and he writes it, and there's a lot of, I'm not 100% happy about the direction it's taken here, and I think technically it's not quite what it was, and so it'd be interesting. I would always love to be able to talk to him saying, okay, you kick this off.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the way that it turned out? You know, and I think there'd be some strong reservations there.
You know, now that you mention it, because he wrote his autobiography, Karate Do My Way of Life, pretty close to the end of his life, correctly. And, you know, it was an autobiography, but he reminisced a lot about his youth and the way, and talked a lot about how karate was back then.
Yeah.
And I could tell, even I read that at a young age, my teacher had me read it before I tested for my first Don. But I remember even then reading it, and I could tell from the description that sounded very, very different than what I thought of as karate, things he was describing.
But I mean, the famous quote from there is the one where he says that the karate that is practiced by high school students today is not the same karate that was practiced 10 years ago, and is a long way indeed from the karate that I practiced in Okinawa as a child. So he acknowledges it's been an evolvement. And part of that evolution was, you know, karate has primarily been spread through the universities. University degree lasts 5-6 years.
Sure.
We've got 5-6 years to teach you as many katas as possible, then we want you on a plane spreading this art. So most of the guys that ended up spreading it had a fairly superficial understanding of it. Well, I'm glad they did it, because that made sure the karate spread. But now I think people are wanting to go back a little bit and see what it was originally all about. Yep. You know?
As we're talking about, I'm actually remembering it now that he talked about doing only Nahachi for 3 years. I remember thinking about that, like he was doing just the solo kata over and over and over, as someone who spent the last year practicing Nahachi almost exclusively, combined with long-range striking and kickboxing, more what people think is more typical karate type stuff. But Yeah, I feel like I could go on for quite a bit longer than that. So 3 years, no longer, doesn't seem surprising at all that he would spend 3 years.
He's one of his teachers, Itosu, created two supplementary versions as well. So it was 9 years he spent on in total. So we assume three on each. So you've got the original Naihachi, which now is called Naihachi Shodan. Then you've got the Nidan and Sandan versions. So that's almost a decade.
Yeah.
And he tells this story about how he said, I would never dare ask to move on the next move.
Yeah.
He said the training was often a painful and humiliating experience. And he uses this thing. He said that I'd master movement, and I asked. He says there was and found out I hadn't mastered. He goes, many a time was I made to eat the dirt on the dojo floor. And like you, when I first read that, I thought that's really cruel. I thought, you know, he's done a move and they've gone, the move is wrong. Eat some dirt. And I'm reading it again. I think he means eat dirt in the way a skateboarder says I ate dirt.
Yeah.
You know, he asked the teacher, I think I've got this move. And then the teacher goes, right, bang, hits the ground.
Yeah.
And you got it, Funakoshi? No, I need to work it some more. Okay, cool. You know, get back up and go again, you know.
All right. Well, you know, thanks for sitting down and talking to me about this. I think it's a really, really interesting subject and one that, you know, I'd love for the karate and the martial arts community in general to have more exposure to, you know, kata in the broader sense, the way that you and other people, you know, do it in the practical karate community, the way that you guys do it. And thanks for having me here this weekend. Another great seminar here, your residential course, in the UK.
Yeah,
I'll look forward to coming back again.
Yeah, it's good to see. So this is, so with the first one of these we did in Canada.
We've
been in the US a few times,
sure.
Now we're here in the UK, so
it's a fun trip.
Yeah,
it's been fun. Okay, all right.